Welcome to Rad Radio. I'm your host, Danny McMartin. For all you Man in the High Castle fans, we have a special treat for you tonight. We have Kari Tagawa here, who plays Trade Minister Togomi in The Man in the High Castle. Kari, how are you doing?
Good, Danny. I'm sorry we couldn't have better weather for you today. It's a bit rainy here in Vancouver.
And cold. I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's so cold. You play Trade Minister Togomi on The Man in the High Castle, which you can stream on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that.
The show itself is based on a 1962 novel by Philip K. Dick. I like to characterize him as an underground science fiction writer, although he's not very underground considering the number of people in the world that have read his books. But at the time it came out, certainly it was hip to be underground. These days it's like all becoming commercial, but certainly at the time it was written, it represented a different style of science fiction writing than other writers at the time. Story about what if, alternative history, what if Japan and Germany had won the war and America was captive and being split up by the two countries, of Germany ruling the East Coast and Japan ruling the West, and what it might be like. Interesting concept, considering that 17 years after the war, one of the most brutally fought and most racist wars, that an American would write a book as if the enemy had won. And in that, the Nazis and the Japanese were so stereotyped and characterized evilly. And of course, the axis of evil has been coined to be and used again in subsequent times. How those two countries might be ruling the United States, how Americans would be reacting. It's a very interesting concept.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's watching the show, and I'm assuming that most people that listen to this will have watched the show, but if you haven't, it's kind of very alarming the way that Americans behave on the show compared to what we're used to now, where, you know, nobody cares and everybody does whatever they want. But on the show, they have to be very respectful, very polite to the Nazi faction, the Japanese faction, and there's different customs for each that they have to adhere to.
Yeah, it's certainly not the norm for American society to consider itself to be the conquered, to be the losers. It's interesting. I came to America in 1955, 56, when I was five, and being born in Tokyo and being raised in North Carolina, Louisiana, and Texas, I was very aware of the difference between Japanese culture and American culture, and certainly it wasn't very popular to be Japanese in America at the time, just 10 years after the war. And to be raised in the U.S. Army was a very unique situation. I liken it to be akin to Stranger in a Strange Land.
Mm-hmm.
Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. There were books that definitely represent a mind frame of what we call in this era the alternate reality.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, a character lives in two different worlds. I think we've been so geared in the U.S. to being used to one frame of mind, one culture, that to consider a character who lives in two different worlds is highly, highly unusual. And that's what science fiction is for, is to make us think about different possible scenarios. So this was something, though, for me at 5 and 6, became very clear. There definitely, this was an alternate reality from what I was used to. So I cherish this role. It's very important to me.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because since I have been here in Vancouver, I've talked to a lot of the locals, and I've been getting the same question every time I talk to someone who's from Canada or from a different country other than the United States and who lives here, and they always ask about our American politics, and what they see on TV is the Republicans and the Democrats and how completely different they are. And they ask me how that can be. How can the two parties be so drastically different from one another? And I explain that people who grow up in rural areas in the United States are brought up very differently from people who grow up in cities. The difference in people in the city and in the rural areas is so extreme, I think, a lot of times.
It is massively, drastically, contrastively different. And the way I liken it, because I am a history buff, I'm not an authority, but certainly growing up in the South, in the U.S. military, experiencing a lot of different stages of certainly racism, stereotypic kind of behavior about everybody, really. What I looked at, and I would suggest for your viewers to watch The Secret History of the United States by Oliver Stone. It was a documentary that is not well known, but he documents sort of the emergence of the American empire. And certainly we think of it as a country, but it has been an empire in terms of sort of policies of other empires.
Yeah.
Of how we have, through our influence, definitely gone out into the world in imperial sort of fashion. Only we certainly had a cover of the word business, which I think really defines the difference between the Democratic and Republican parties, is definitely the rural kind of consciousness that you're talking about. Certainly that would be the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Farming culture that before the World War II was massive, and very much of what the majority of America was about. It was really the Midwest,
right,
and the West.
And everyone else.
Yeah, and then on the coast, you had New York and, right, and Los Angeles and budding sort of cities.
Incidentally, I grew up in Iowa, just in case anyone wanted to know. So I know all about what you're talking about.
Well, I've had contact with Midwestern people, and something very, in terms of a culture, is critically important to have cultures that were raised in nature as farmers. You don't let nature know what time you want it to rain or when it's going to snow, or you really adjust to nature's rhythm. And I think the difference between cultures that are raised with nature and cultures that aren't, like in the city, they really don't pay attention to nature. It's like, nature's in the way, we don't need it to rain, and as if there's anything that you could really do about it. But somehow city cultures, in not being raised with that sort of natural law that they have to pay attention to, they sort of create their own laws. And I think that's the culture that has really developed this business culture in America, and how things are for profit and corporations, and certainly reflected in this election with the likes of Trump.
That's another thing I've gotten since I've been here. People, like, if they hear me speak, they know I'm American immediately, and I don't even know how that is, because I can't tell when someone's Canadian. They don't have an accent to me, but apparently I do to them.
Yeah.
And so they'll stop me and they'll say, "What's going on with your politics? We're frightened for you." They say, "We're frightened for you." And I'm like, "Hey, we're just all sitting here with our hands in the air. We don't know what's going on either." Everybody's like, "What the hell's happening?"
Yeah, it's the business values and the farming values.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, it's kind of contradictory in this way, too. You would think that if people in the Midwest who had to live by nature's laws and understood that anybody under nature is equal and has to do the same kind of work and adjust to all the natural laws, that they would be more liberal in one sense of humanity,
mm-hmm.
not versus nature, but living within nature. Whereas business pays no attention to nature, can do whatever it wants to the environment, to other people. There doesn't seem to be, and this is just a very subjective perspective, but doesn't seem to be as much consideration about each other, about other members of humanity. It's who rises to the top with the power of business, whereas the other party, the Democratic Party, seems to be all about considering people's rights, respect, all those kind of values that have become very clear in this election. The difference between the two parties that way.
I think, and I agree, but I also think that both parties pander quite a lot to, you know, emotional triggers mm-hmm. of people.
Yeah.
I mean, both of them. Let's just say I feel like Trump does it a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to give away, like, any political leanings, but I'm just saying I feel like there's an awful lot of pandering going on.
Mm.
I think after this election, it's going to leave it wide open for other parties to come in and maybe gain some ground. You know, there's not a lot of choices for Americans as far as who to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem. Someone was telling me that they have several different parties to choose from in other countries, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that it's always a 3 or 4 way race.
Mm-hmm.
It's never like that in the U.S. It's a 2 way race, and that's all there is to it. So, but moving on a little bit, getting back to the show, it is important because of your Japanese heritage, I know, for you, but also it's a different kind of character than you normally play.
Yeah, the history of my career is been very extreme. I started out playing bad guys, and not by choice. I definitely accepted those roles, knowing that the biggest thing for an actor is to work, is to be out there, you know, and they say you're only as good as your last film. So the thing is to be current, to have things that are projects that you've done recently. And certainly the beginning of my career was like that, in the midst of late 80s, early 90s, with the three networks and as many programs that were on, Hotel, MacGyver. Just every show had need of an Asian bad guy. So I kind of filled that role for that period of the late 80s, early 90s. And
personally, my favorite was mm-hmm. Eddie Sakatumi on Rising Sun.
Oh, that's sweet. He was a likable guy.
He was
actually one of the, not necessarily bad, but he definitely rode the edge very cautiously. And I felt, too, it served a purpose. One of my purposes was to portray Asian males as being virile and not just wimps and silly businessmen running around with cameras slung around their neck with Coke bottle glasses. I mean, that's such a period that I grew up in, was watching images of Asian, not only Japanese, but certainly Asian males as being very emasculated. So, Bad Guys was one way to make sure the audience knew that there were Asian men, albeit bad guys and drug dealers and just people that you wouldn't want to introduce to your parents. But
it, not taking home the mom.
Yeah, kind of thing. But very much men of a certain power and a certain kind of strength in the pirate.
Well, you know what's funny is everyone kind of looks the same size on screen. And in person, you are quite large and tall, which I think people would not know. I mean, looking on screen, everybody looks the same size, kind of. You don't really, I don't know if it's the camera angle or how they do that, but everybody looks the same.
The perfect example is X-Files. Oh my God, I just started watching that with my daughter recently. The size difference between those two is so drastic. And yet when they sat in the car, they were the same height. It just means they put a bunch of cushions under.
It's kind of crazy.
And so a lot of times I did shoot with good guys who were smaller. And then so they used camera angles. I was somewhat smaller in the beginning of my career. Gained size as I've gone along. But yeah, I'm definitely not the average size Japanese.
That's for sure.
But yeah. I think a lot of it had to do when we were growing up that we practically had steak every day. And I'm sure on top of my lineage being somewhat bigger, my father was big for his day and age, but also I think there must have been something in the meat, as we found out and we know today.
Yeah. You know what's so funny though? Since I've been here in Vancouver, everyone's taller than me. I'm like, what has happened to people? People are huge, right? Someone told me that Americans are now the shortest that they've ever been. 20 years or something.
That's believable. I've noticed too that here in Canada that there's some amazingly large people.
Yes.
They're amazingly large. The men and women.
Yes.
I just can't believe it's like a whole other category. And also during the war, the Imperial Japanese Marines were all 6 feet. I mean, there was a group of them. They had to be 6 feet. So, yeah, I think I come from part of those two.
Yeah, there's a huge Asian population here in Vancouver also, and they're all tall.
They certainly are. You know, and for extras for our show, it just amazed me how many of those extras they used to play Japanese soldiers were tall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just around 6 feet tall, if not taller. It's unusual for a show to have that many Asians and that many tall Asians.
Yeah, that's like half the cast, though. The other half are... Like,
yeah.
What? Over Grubenfuhrers. Yeah. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
I had to practice saying that a couple times. I'm like, what is that? You hear it on the show. And I was like, what are they saying? What?
Yeah, it is kind of a long word to have as a title.
How many times do people trip up on set when they're trying to say that word? You know, we
don't have that. I mean, I think for actors, it's another word, and you know, as much as dialogue is critical, I mean, you just do it. It's just part of natural.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, Give us a little bit of the dirt on set. How much dirt can you give us?
And we actually have someone walking around sweeping up the floor, so it's never dirty on set. There's one thing I can say about this particular group. It's a highly, highly unusual group of actors and producers. It's the most... I don't know how everybody defines the word intelligent, but there's a level of IQ, it feels like, in the way we treat each other, we talk to each other, it's done with respect. It's such a varied group of the level of producers. Mm-hmm. People from Ridley Scott's organization.
Yeah, Ridley Scott produces this, right?
Yeah, and he's certainly the executive producers. Another one is Issa Dick, whose father is Philip K. Dick. And just the consideration to keep the show at a, highbrow level, not to let it sink to the typical mechanisms that a lot of network televisions use. Conventionalism is kind of out the window, but that has a lot to do with Amazon too. They tend to gravitate toward things, shows that are on the edge. Shows that present new ideas.
Yeah, let's talk about Amazon for a minute now. I heard somewhere that Man in the High Castle is their top show right now. It's their highest streaming show.
Yeah.
And so you guys are like getting a big budget.
It's
an incredible production.
It's amazing to be on a show that really feels like groundbreaking, not only material, but starting a whole new category, which I think is critical for millennials, that they're not just watching sort of regurgitated old material from the three networks, and certainly HBO and Netflix, Hulu, the new networks that are coming up now.
Yeah. Definitely makes you think. The show makes you think.
It's a thinking show. It's definitely not...
It's not a casual watching show. By any means.
No, it'll pull you in.
Yeah.
And for some people, it can be too intense. Although...
They need the epileptic seizure warning at the beginning of the show. You know how, like, when you play video games?
I haven't seen that warning, no.
Because of the, you know, intensity of the game, and a lot of times it's the lighting and stuff, they give an epileptic seizure warning. People with epilepsy shouldn't play, may cause seizures, that sort of thing. Probably what they need to do with the show.
Probably a little bit less than video game sort of hyper, super, over-the-top stimulation. But
it's literally the same type of thing. Like, a lot of video games are very military-oriented and very intense, and you have to pay close attention.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the warning comes in.
Mm-mm-mm.
So if you're watching this show, you know, we're just going to put a disclaimer out there right now.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's so intense, and it's not something where you have to pay attention. It's not something where you could be watching it and playing in the kitchen. You have to, like, sit down and focus on the show, which is, I think, part of the reason why it sucks people in. It's excellent. But.
Yeah, and the fact that there aren't a lot of shows that you can watch that require that kind of focus and that kind of stimulation of thinking.
Yeah.
It definitely is in a category unto itself now. And hopefully with Amazon's help and sort of influence, that we can start developing a whole, and I like to think of it as a movement, in having more far-reaching influence on world society, just by stimulating people's sort of thought about each other and how much, you know, we tend to categorically put people into boxes and,
right,
and into racial differences. This show really looks at people who we would have believed to be the enemy, how human the enemy can be, and how they make mistakes and how they recover and treat each other is not that different. That's one thing about the history of the United States, and that's why I recommend this Oliver Stone documentary, Secret History of the United States.
Well, I have not seen it, but I'm definitely going to be checking it out when I get back home. The States, by the way, Vancouver is the most beautiful city.
Mm-hmm.
It is so lovely here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm ready to defect. You know, I've been talking about it, and I've been saying, you know, I think I could defect to Canada if it was necessary. I think, yeah.
I think whatever defect means, you certainly
believe.
I would consider having dual citizenship, if anything.
Yeah.
I think there's still an importance of the role of the United States on the planet. It has not reached its full peak of what it could be. I think this time now is like time out in school when they put you in the corner and make you just be quiet for a while. I think we need one of those timeouts. This is not a time to jump into a whole old school frame of mind where the U.S. was dominantly ruling the world practically through our influence in business and mm-hmm. our sort of covert entities in our government. It's time things have to be a little bit more open, transparent, and really respectful in a global society.
I agree.
Too many people to understand, not misunderstand or mischaracterize. That's always a problem with pop culture, because it looks to, especially a pop culture that's so hyped for commercialism, how much you have to sell a product.
And do you guys have product placement on the show? Are you like, oh, we can't use this certain product unless we get like
an okay, you always have to do that, or turn the can around sideways so you can't read
right.
the label.
Or do you have any deals with product? I mean, you have to say who, but like certain products that you feature every show?
No, not every show. Uh-huh. And certainly we've used products that are commercial products. And I had an experience with that, of having to eat a product that I actually started to get ill from eating, shooting time after time. That's one thing about eating things, too, in this business. You have to be careful, because you don't know how many times you're going to have to be
right.
shot eating. So you
don't eat that day if you have to.
Or how to fake it.
Like
a little bit better.
Waste basket for you to spit it out.
I've had that happen, certainly. Yeah, so.
It may or may not be my favorite product, which I won't mention until after the episode comes out. But we've talked about it.
It's, I mean, any food that's produced that could survive a nuclear blast is not made
for
consumption.
It's probably not healthy, no.
Not made for someone remaining healthy. It's to sell their product.
Right.
For sure, it's weird.
I think somewhere there's a 25-year-old Happy Meal in a museum that has not molded yet. Gosh, I don't even know where I saw that somewhere on the internet, but there's a Happy Meal in a museum somewhere. It's like 20 years old. There's no mold on it.
That's kind of like the pyramids and that whole technology. Yeah, and I read, this was like years ago, that they tested the sugar content by dropping a tooth into the soda, and it dissolved the tooth.
Oh my goodness. Completely. I know. I love soda too. I've been trying to limit myself because, it's like everything. Find out it's bad and then you don't do it as much or you stop doing it. But I'm not a quitter. But I do.
Yeah. I'm addicted and I'm not a quitter. Well, that it all goes back to this thing in America when you asked about America. And you stop and you think about it. This election represents so much a difference in consciousness of an old school in which America in the world was leading, good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, there were good things about it, there are bad things about it, and other things that just make you wonder, what's at the core of a country that has such a diversity of seemingly positive and negative effects on the planet? And I think there will never be an election like this ever again in the history of the United States.
Let's hope so.
Well,
I'm hoping there isn't, because, man, it's ridiculous. It's literally a circus right now.
No, it is. It's definitely a circus with a ringleader.
Mm-hmm. Some monkeys people are tossing around.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that it's woken up the millennials.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as people speak badly about the millennials, I still hold out a great hope for the millennials and moving forward. They found out they have power.
Yeah.
They have power to vote. And that's the beauty of a democracy. There's a lot of problems with democracies, but ultimately it's only one vote for one person. Trump doesn't get three votes, he gets one. And so in that even young people that haven't even come out and made a dent in society, that before they do, just the fact that they reach a voting age, that they can cast a vote, they really found out how much difference they can make. And that won't go away. It's like opening up Pandora's box.
It's important, though.
Yeah, so that the elections have another 4 years till they have a presidential election, but there are an awful lot of elections in between. Bernie Sanders brought out to be such a radical, to use words that we've never heard in this level of American politics, like revolution, socialist, about how much change you're looking to make. They're not unlike changes that are implemented already in the world.
Right.
To have female leaders, just even be talking about Hillary Clinton. We're one of the few countries that hadn't had a female leader.
I know. And people think we're so progressive getting a female, presidential candidate. But I'm here to tell you, people, we are behind the times.
Way behind.
Way behind the times.
And technologically behind. It's pretty sad.
Yeah. I mean, it's great for the United States that we do have a female candidate, but it's so long overdue, at this point. But you were talking about millennials, and I wanted to bring up something important, because they do get a bad rap, I think.
Huge, because of selfies and
all that narcissistic bullshit, we know.
Some cities that want to give tickets for people texting while they're walking down the street.
Yeah.
Possibly just stepping out into traffic. And they've had those kind of situations, or texting while driving, and this driver hit a woman who was on her bike, killed all three of them, and two children in one of those little bicycle trailer things. So it's definitely out of hand. All based on the idea, and I've always had this concept in mind, that if it's about human beings, it breaks down to two very simple principles. What I think of me, and what I think that you think of me.
Right.
Identity.
Have you not ever heard that saying, what other people think of me is none of my business?
No, I hadn't.
It's a great saying, because if you don't care, then, I mean, then you don't care.
A little difficult to do.
What is
easier said than done.
For you.
Well, no, just...
You've got to be...
I think in our society in general, because we're so guided by media and advertising especially. Subliminal programming, which is still legal in the United States. That means...
Listen to Rad Radio.
Something.
That was subliminal programming. Did you guys hear that?
That means somebody's able to implement something into your brain without you knowing it.
Right.
Which has been going on since the beginning of advertising.
Right. I mean, people do it all the time, listen to Rad Radio. I mean, not us. Listen to Rad Radio.
About...
Other people do.
I mean, if rape is carnal knowledge without consent,
right,
then we're being raped.
Mind raped.
By advertising.
You probably just offended a whole bunch of people.
Especially the advertisers.
Right?
But all the more reason, and this seems like what this election's about, it's like letting us know there are issues we can no longer... not deal with.
I agree.
It's everything's on the table now.
Yeah, but you know what? I think it depends on who gets elected, because it could be swept right back under the rug. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen here. I think we're all... But it has been brought to the forefront. I just don't know what we're going to do with it, because Americans have a history of forgetting something very quickly and going back about their daily lives as if nothing happened. I mean, I see that often.
Well, the one difference, I think, at this time in history is the world has not been in this much crisis, the high-pitched level of crisis around the planet. So we are in the context, living in a context that has so much effect what happened in this election. For us and the future of the world, we could get totally left out unless we made a certain kind of decision that would include more of the world.
Right.
It's not a time to get isolationist and talk about principles that would eliminate us from being more respectful of other cultures, being more aware of we are part of a bigger piece. When you consider yourself and other people consider you to be number one and the leader, you don't have to much consider other people.
Right.
Although you live in a business context and you've got to deal with them, but to really live in respect and honor of who they are, not demean them because they're different.
Right.
Just such a
foreign
idea. And we'll see. That's why I have hope in the millennials. They're growing up with a whole new opportunity to shape things that they want to. And they're going to make mistakes. Everybody does. It's what you do with mistakes that determines whether you've won or you lost. To me, you lose if you make a mistake and don't get back up.
Yeah.
You win if you learn what the causes of that mistake are about and not take it into an ego, arrogant kind of place.
Well, you know, I think that's part of the problem in America. We crucify political leaders who make mistakes. We don't let them, we don't forgive them. Or, you know, even something as simple as switching to a different party. We crucify them. Well, you said this thing and now you believe that thing. Well, maybe somebody learned and they are trying to do the right thing, you know, but we don't allow for that to happen.
Yeah.
I think that's a real problem.
That is, and it's also problematic of a society that's so influenced by hype and media in a way that we almost depend on being able to have things be so black and white. So it's either this or that. When in fact, life is so much of finding other solutions, about having to deal in different ways than just very extreme one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have been talking about politics so much, but it's such a hot button topic right now. You almost can't be from the United States and not talk about it. It is so outrageous at this moment that I think it seems to be what is occupying everyone's mind all the time. And we're so close to the elections that I think, you know, people are freaking out. I'm freaking out. I'm a little freaked out.
It's never been quite this extreme, with so much at stake, and kind of like no way back. But that's also, when you think about it, in the scheme of a natural flow of events based on certain energies being the way they are, this was inevitable that we'd get to this point at some time.
Yeah.
My sense of it is, if it was going to be, bring it on now. Let's deal with it now.
Right?
Let's not delay anymore. Let's not hide our heads in the sand about it anymore. Let's bring it to the table, and let's really actually make a true decision about it.
Yeah. And so, I don't know if you knew this, but we have an international audience. And this show can be heard like anywhere in the world that can get an internet service. So, I mean, there's probably lots of people listening right now from other countries who are going to be a little bit more enlightened about how I think American people feel over here. I think they see our politics on TV and they're like, those people are crazy. But we're all just as bewildered, I think, as to how it got to the point that it has, you know, and, I have noticed we are so far behind compared to other countries as far as we're like the toddler of the world emotionally, almost. I mean, we've always said, well, America's a melting pot, you know, but it's really not. Being up here in Vancouver, it's much more racially diverse than America. And, you know, America's more like a petri dish at this point than a melting pot. And I feel, something that I noticed the other day, it was the Pride festivities here, and I went to the Pride parade, and things that I noticed that would never happen in the United States was that almost every business in the city was sponsoring the Pride parade. Banks, you know, corporations. I saw floats for Marshalls and TJ Maxx Home Goods and places like that. You wouldn't see that in the United States. Businesses like that supporting Pride festivities.
No, and I think we certainly are in the United States moving quickly in that direction. And we're seeing that in companies when they're anti-LGBT and groups or statements that are made, companies withdraw their support from those people because commercially is now the point where LGBT is such an economic force.
Yeah.
So much disposable income that it can really hurt businesses not to be supported. I mean, even the military has gotten to the point of accepting people on all sexual gender levels as long as they follow that specific kind of format for what loyalty is and to do the work as it should be. We shouldn't let sort of our own sort of limited stereotypic nonsense stop from accepting people as people.
It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, where people in the cities are brought up so much differently than people in rural areas, and I think it's because we learn from experience, and that's how we grow, that's how we learn, that's how we grow up. So if you're in an area where you haven't experienced different cultures, you know, LGBTQ people, different races, different religions, if you have not experienced that, your knowledge is so limited. But I mean, you can only go on what you know. I think on a one-on-one level, you know, we meet people that are different than us and we enjoy them. But I think, you know, on a massive level, in these areas where there is no diversity, that's a big problem in the United States as far as us being able to advance to accepting all types of people, you know? And I'm not saying everyone's going to get mad, be like, oh, she wants to open our borders and just let everybody come in. That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we have people here right now that we need to accept and get to know and enjoy different cultures. There's nothing wrong with it. There's, you know, nothing wrong with enjoying different cultures. Since I've been here, I walked three blocks from here, and there's absolutely every kind of restaurant from every country you can think of down the road, you know? I mean, different types of people all over the place, and it's not something I think we're very tolerant of.
Well, yeah, and certainly America's a young country. Mm-hmm. When you look at people from different countries, and you find out how old their histories are, our history is so young.
Yeah.
You know, it's still a works in progress. It's still an experiment. We're still learning things that other cultures had quite a while to digest already. We're still kind of just barely getting at the nibbling of the food.
Yeah.
Hasn't gotten the digestion quite yet. And the beauty of America is that it is probably in the history of the world culture that, because it's a pop culture, it always looks to new ideas to fill that space.
Right.
You have to have that, or else the culture kind of gets stagnant.
Yeah.
So we'll get the rhythm.
Right. And I'm not anti-American by any means.
No,
I don't want anyone to
I
get
know,
that idea.
No,
I
no,
love
no,
my
no.
country. We still have freedoms that most countries don't, and I love that. And I especially love Denver area where I live, you know, where we have progressed to legalizing marijuana, which has been a huge profit for our state. You know, we have a budget surplus, crime's down, you know, illegal drug use is down, and it's been very beneficial. You know,
and that's
for
a
beauty, area.
Too, for America. Is we have a right to have an opinion that doesn't always agree with somebody who feels that just by saying, you know, I am America, USA, USA,
mm-hmm.
That makes you wrong or them wrong. You know, it's just a matter of personal opinion. And so how to keep increasing, going wide, you know, we've always been about progress going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the world today, to me, what seems to be more important than trying to prove you're number one, call somebody's culture your national interest. When I started really thinking about the word national interest, how much it's used in politics,
mm-hmm.
that simply means, do we have in our country's name an interest in having what they have? Is there a reason to have access to their oil? Do we have a Those
yeah.
are interests, and typically they're business interests. It's not anything to do with the people.
Mm-hmm.
How business overrides human relationships, it's pretty amazingly narrow-minded.
Yeah.
And I think it's time we become a little bit more aware of where what direction the planet's going. If we want to be part of the world, we need to start becoming more aware of the world and not the world that simply has us as the leader or number one or whatever we think that we want to call ourselves.
Right.
It'd be nice to have a world that includes more cultures.
I agree. I mean, I love America, but I love more what America could be and what I think it will be. You know, I just think we have a few things to straighten out right now that need to take priority, you know, as far as taking care of the citizens of our great nation. I think that needs to become a priority. And I just, you know, I'm not saying like free medical care and all that. I mean taking care of people emotionally, just becoming a little bit kinder nation, you know, and maybe a little bit kinder to your next door neighbor or whatever you want to do, you know, to contribute to that. And maybe, you know, leaving here and holding the door open for someone or whatever, you know.
Well, you mentioned the word healthcare. I don't think that's outrageous to think of, if not free healthcare, a more comprehensive understanding of what health is.
Yeah.
An understanding of our bodies, understanding that there are medical systems in the world that consider that left to itself, the body can take care of itself.
Yeah.
If you're putting things in it that are counter to that, certainly health is a little bit hard to achieve. If we really understood the power of that body, its ability to heal itself, its ability to cleanse itself, then I think we have a much better chance at a clear program of healthcare, not only here, because it's certainly a healthcare crisis around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't mention some of the culprits that make money from the confusion and the...
We won't mention Big Pharma. Whoops, did I say that? I did not say that.
You said it. Disinformation, you know.
Everybody's thinking it, I'll say it.
Well, that's it. And that's the kind of time it is. We need to have certain things transparent. We need to have things on the table that we don't have to hide from, that we don't have to be afraid of.
Yeah.
Because especially with these millennials, they know every level of BS because they've grown up with it. They're so aware of it. So for anything to be a new idea, it would have to come from a different direction, perspective, and that's what certainly healthcare is.
I think that this is a great segue to talk about all the stuff that you do with the breathing exercises and that program that you have.
Well, the program's called Chu Shin Do, and it's an original system of, it sounds like another martial arts, and certainly that has been influenced by martial arts, but more so from the side of martial arts is the healing, martial healing. And certainly there are systems out there like what we consider with Tai Chi, with system like Qigong. Excuse me for forgetting, I'm just that brain freeze every once in a while. But we're finding out that certainly there are aspects to martial arts that are in balance with other parts of their system. So the fighting and the healing together were taught way in the beginning. It's been such a long time that martial arts has been around. Certainly we don't consider that martial arts may be one of the most comprehensive perspectives of the body itself. Acupuncture was a system that was certainly accentuated by the fact that when soldiers would be shot with arrows on the battlefield, that there were certain other symptoms that were being relieved by these specific points on the body, and then they started tracking energetic movements. The one thing that's clear about the difference, huge difference between Eastern and Western medicine, the concept of qi, or the movement of energy through the body that isn't necessarily pharmaceutical-based or diagnosis-based even.
Right, stay off the drugs, kids.
Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah.
We've definitely had and a growing problem with pharmaceutical answers to diseases and really maladies that have, I believe, and being a person of zero authority in terms of degrees or expertise in Western medicine or Eastern medicine even. And I've looked at some basic principles that I believe that the body is based on. And something as simple as the level of metabolism in the body, the ability to make use of oxygen, oxygenated blood, circulation system, the respiratory system. There's some basic principles that are so different than a Western perspective of health. When you stop and look at the history of Western medicine having its greatest boost forward with the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really battlefield medicine, emergency medicine, how you stop the bleeding, how you heal the wound, and get them back out there to fight as soon as possible.
If people wanted to look into this, where could they go on the internet? Go to your website?
You can go to the website. It's pretty simple information, and I've purposely done so because when this concept gets out, I want to certainly devote more time than I have at the moment. And also, I feel like by putting out bits of information, that those that resonate with it will start to create a relationship with it themselves. I'm very much about a different way of teaching and learning.
So what is the website, by the way?
It's my name, Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa. It's a long name.
I never pronounce the middle part. I just say Kari
Tagawa
because I can't.
If you remember the word hero.
Hiroyuki.
Yeah.
I know what it is. I'm just
positive.
Now I take the shortcut.
And I at first was very much against using my whole name for that reason. It's way long, but it also is another reason. I think we have to be challenged once in a while to go beyond whatever we think our limitations are, to get out of our comfort zone. And so to have a system that's being presented in sort of oblique, kind of unique fashion, it's how to put a little information out, make sure that that information is powerful enough to stimulate a curiosity about it rather than overdoing it in the sort of a Western advertising model that you have to convince someone through subliminal programming or hype it up with a whole lot of other stuff. I'd rather have people who come to it with a sincere desire to make a difference in sort of the quality of their health. Try a few simple exercises, and if they work for them, then please continue. But I don't want to be selling people to try it.
Right.
I'm just very much
if they want it, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you're like openly pushing right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The few facts about it, though, just as an enticement and titillating facts. I haven't heard enough from the Western perspective that unless you affect the cellular level of health, there's so many possibilities for detours and complications when the simplest form of health is affecting your cellular metabolism. How well that cell is metabolizing oxygen from the blood. How well it's getting rid of the byproducts of that metabolism. So it's simply how you bring in fresh energy and how you get rid of the bad energy. That's
right.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. You know what? My dad's listening probably. He's going to be listening to this and he's going to say, I told you to walk it off.
To what?
To walk it off.
Walk it off.
I told you, just walk it off.
Well, that's not a bad concept.
It's not.
We have, you know, part of that in Western medicine, which says to do light exercise.
Right.
the fact is that any kind of body movement, and even if it's just simple walking, by the body moving, it's going to promote circulation. Circulation is going to promote the movement of the lungs to metabolize. It calls on the heart, and we focus so much on the heart. We haven't talked much about the lungs. But in that sense, it's just my belief that the lungs have a greater effect on circulation than does the heart. The heart is a handful of muscle. And certainly there's no denying it's the pump. It does move blood through. But my contention is that if the lungs are used more completely, they say the average person uses about 15% of their lungs, that if you can increase that capacity, that circulation will take place without taxing the heart. The heart can still pump. It just means it doesn't have to be overworked in order to achieve that circulation.
Plus, you've got to have your blood oxygenated. It doesn't do your heart any good to like be pumping blood that's not properly oxygenated.
Absolutely. And so any increase in heart rate definitely requires that more oxygen be available. It can stimulate the lungs. That connection between the heart and lungs, we still haven't looked at thoroughly enough yet. But my sense of it is that we can create more circulation without overworking the heart. And that should be good news to people with heart problems, that they can increase their heart function without stressing it.
I love that idea, and you've been working with me, and I will tell you guys, it's uncomfortable, but it absolutely is effective. Just even after a couple tries, it is effective. So I would definitely look it up, go give it a shot, go check it out. It helps me, and I've got a lot of stuff going on right now, so it is effective. But I'm going to put the disclaimer out that it's a little uncomfortable when you first start.
And in that, let me ask you a few questions so that we can get a clear understanding of what the word uncomfortable means. So physically, our society is geared toward, if you feel any physical pain, you need to stop from doing it.
Right.
And that's uncomfortable. It's even an uncomfortable idea that somebody says, we're looking for uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's so counter to what our brain tells us logically that we should be doing. If it's uncomfortable, if it's painful, you need to stop immediately. Because the chances are that will increase. And because we don't have a measure for what that is, or anything authoritatively research-wise that says that pain can't be dealt with in most instances, then it's better to back off before you continue anything. But the fact that this particular system believes in the power of breath, and it's been proven, and it was proven in working I'm going to assume, in that uncomfortability, certainly with the breathing, created a greater level of comfortability.
It did. And it's like any exercise that you program, that you start in the beginning, it's not necessarily going to be real comfortable because, you're not used to it. Your body's not used to it. People say all the time after a workout they feel amazing. And that really is after you're finished with the exercises, you do feel better. You feel a lot better.
And probably you can make the statement that when you're talking about other physical systems, where you go to the gym, when you start, certainly it doesn't feel comfortable. It's not usual.
Right.
You get out of your comfort zone to even continue. After a certain point, your mind has to make up a choice, decide on a choice. Is this worth it? Or at what cost do we want to even continue something that feels so uncomfortable? And typically, when people finish physical exercise, they do feel better. And there's reasons for it. And one of them is oxygen. Yeah. Getting more oxygen to the brain definitely causes a more pleasant feeling, not to mention the endorphins.
It is definitely, you feel much more relaxed after you do the exercises than you did before. Like, I was so tense, and then afterwards I was not quite as tense, and that relieves a whole lot of symptoms when you learn to relax.
And in typical, like, gym-oriented systems, they have a saying, of course, no pain, no gain.
That's not my philosophy.
No, and typically it's about a very aggressive, pushy kind of attitude.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's not my philosophy.
No.
But even someone like me can do this program.
Well, in this, it's about no pain, no gain. This system is about no pain, all gain. So although pain is included, that by doing the breathing, that pain dissipates. And that is a radical idea in itself. Something I could go on talking about forever. But the simplicity of the system, number one, is dealing with breathing. Breathing is not a difficult exercise. It's highly unusual that people don't immediately, when working in this system, start to feel like they really are working. You know, typically, for the body to feel like it's really working, you get on the treadmill and you keep increasing the speed, or you're lifting weights, you increase the weights. You can tell what the workload is immediately by how the body's reacting to doing more of anything. In the breathing, it's amazing how much work that you experience through so little work.
And I wouldn't even call it painful. I mean, you said it's kind of a little bit of pain. I wouldn't even call it painful. Maybe a little uncomfortable, but not actual pain, not like real pain.
Not like getting hit in the head.
No.
So it makes you become aware of certain parts of your body that are holding tension. Mm-hmm. And typically tension is a part of the body that the muscles are tight, squeezing off the circulation and stimulating the nervous system in a way to let us know that there's something not quite right in that area. But through this breathing is a very gentle way of accessing that point to create a proper function of circulation, of oxygenation, and thereby allowing more function and mobility of that area, which is highly unusual when you think about our sort of modern physical systems. This is definitely about creating a level of comfort in areas that were uncomfortable.
So if anyone wants to check it out, go to carryhiroyukitagawa.com, right? All right?
Okay. Very rudimentary information there. And will soon be increased. In fact, we're working on ideas to develop an app for it. Not that everything else isn't apt in the
world. That's not, but that's brilliant, because that's what everyone does now. If it's easily accessible, you know, it's got to be easily accessible. Otherwise, people are like, nope, I'm out.
Well, here's one simple thing, too, part of this app. I've been experimenting with shoes because I feel the feet are critical to our health. And in that...
Are you wearing Uggs right now?
I'm wearing Uggs right now.
I am not wearing shoes.
I'm always about keeping my feet warm, too. Yeah. I'm very much about comfort of feet. And so I've developed a way to retie sneakers and regular sports shoes, you know, with all the big makers, that have a shoe lacing system that hasn't changed. I don't know when that began, when lacing shoes began, but certainly thinking back to, the mid-1800s, when cowboys didn't have any shoelaces. There's a historical pattern to lacing shoes this is part of a new movement to relay shoes. And runner shoes, they've been experimenting with ways to retie the shoes that will make running more effective.
How do you even think of this?
I was playing around one day with just style. I'm really into style. I'm into fashion. I want to start my own fashion line.
I have noticed that. Everywhere you went, people were commenting on what you were wearing, and you had told me that you designed those pants that you had on.
Yeah, they're designed around pants like in martial arts and a certain period in Japanese history that were very wide pants. And typically in martial arts, Aikido uses that sort of dress where very, very wide, massively wide.
They were big
legs.
Pants.
Yeah.
But they looked entirely comfortable and they looked really lovely, especially with the whole outfit that you had put together. It was.
Well, and certainly there's the other side of it. My friend really considered it to be laughable. And I wear my Japanese wooden shoes and they call them clodhoppers. And he goes, yeah, the weird pants you wear with your clodhoppers. Certainly there's room for some humor in it for some people.
You could probably do a little tap dance with them.
Kind of thing. I can run in those shoes too.
You cannot.
Yeah, I
can. You can.
There's, in fact, in the Honolulu Marathon, there are people that run in those shoes for a whole marathon.
That's loud.
It's loud.
They're not quiet shoes.
Sorry?
They're not quiet shoes.
No, they're not quiet. No, you can't ever sneak up on them. But,
yeah.
But the design of the Japanese wooden shoes have in mind functionality of the foot in a way that makes you run in a different style than what we're used to in the Olympics with a 100-meter run. And everyone runs the same style, and they're wearing shoes that are very similar. Everything about what I do starts in unconventionality, out-of-the-box thinking. And this so happens that a lot of those ideas have been realized a long time ago in Japan, and certainly coming from a whole different concept of the body, and not to get into any religious argument about evolution, but certainly martial arts considers the body in its movement to come from animal-like. How we're able to have different animal styles of martial arts based on moving like them. And
would that be, now that's Japanese culture, but like everyone goes to the Chinese restaurants and sees the Chinese zodiac has, it's all animals. I mean, is that just true throughout Asian countries?
Well, especially the connection between China and Japan. They share an alphabet.
Uh-huh.
The Japanese have certainly modified it a lot, but so much of what the base philosophies of China, the principles of virtue, of honesty, of all those great qualities are from China. Japan certainly borrowed a lot of Chinese cultural points. Yeah, and Japanese have tweaked them a bit. If anything, develop hybrid ideas. But certainly the animal body, the Chinese martial arts.
It's also a very heavy Native American theme, too. Many cultures deal with elements of different types of animals that they apply to human beings.
And I think it has a lot to do somehow that you try to leave religion out of discussions about cultures, it eventually has some reference point to it. And
it's all going to blow up now. Oh no, they mentioned religion.
Well, and in that way, like I said from the beginning, I don't want to get into arguments.
We're just
going to
cover all of it on this show. Everything.
I don't want to get into some argument about evolution, but it's very clear that our bodies have some great similarities to animal and movement. That without considering that where we are and the level of physicality as humans, we consider ourselves to be the peak of the evolutionary chain. There's so much more that we have to learn about the body in and of itself, its movements, the functionality of it, the health of it. It's something that that's certainly been a great interest in my life. It began before I went to Hollywood. So I always made a vow that if I ever reached a certain part, a certain level in Hollywood, to be film, that I would use that sort of notoriety to bring this system to the forefront, because I really very, very committedly believe in it.
Uh-huh.
And I've worked with people with different situations, physical situations, that I found with breathing can be, you gotta be careful what word you use here, healed, relieved, all those things that
relaxed
would
be a good one.
Want to use, because it's definitely can have legal ramifications.
Let's
so,
say enlightened, improved circulation and breathing. I mean, we're not going to say it's 100% guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, we don't guarantee anything on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Just no. So.
Well, you can use the word improved circulation. Improved respiration,
yeah.
And leading to improved posture. If all those things have a connection, then that to me is the core of what the study of the system is about, is in its improvements in different areas. How to overall experience, well, like with what we did with 12 breaths and the difference between how you felt before we started to after.
Yeah, it was really a big difference.
That much oxygenation in 12 breaths, it's not very much of a commitment to ask of people.
It's not.
To experience, to try it. It
takes like 10 minutes.
And for it to have that dramatic an effect on physicality, on movement, on oxygenation of the brain, how much a mood-altering experience it is to have a body that...
It is mood-altering.
It changes your mood because you're getting more oxygen to the whole body.
That's your natural drug.
It's a natural drug. A drug, and a drug is kind of cheapening the use of that. The word
I
with
know.
Oxygen.
What other words you
well,
want me?
Well, drug is a four-letter word, right? So
right.
Breath is not a four-letter word.
No.
But
I know some other four-letter words.
it does have a much... In fact, to me, the difference between a drug is a drug can wear off. Breathing has such a dramatic effect on the natural functioning of the body that it doesn't wear off.
It really was improvement, and it's kind of something I think that you could even possibly do while meditating. I don't know. I mean, you have to consciously think about it, so maybe you can do it in yourself, you know, but it's definitely, I felt so much better, and anybody can do it, and it only takes like 10 minutes. It's so not much of a commitment.
Yeah, and you didn't have to think about breath. You didn't have to think about what is happening. It goes beyond thinking. We place too much emphasis, focus on thinking. There's so much more to life than thinking. Which kind of says, when you're thinking about it, that then what's the balance? Not thinking? Yeah.
But when you think too much about things,
yeah.
You screw yourself up.
There's no doubt about
that. Oh, I'm so bad about that. This is why I don't sleep. So, you know, that the breathing would definitely help.
Yeah.
Like a bedtime would be
yeah.
a great time to do it. Because it does kind of get you, you concentrate on the breathing. You don't concentrate on everything else. That's what I was kind of saying earlier when I said you kind of have to think about it, but only the breathing part. You're not thinking about why is our ecosystem so screwed up and EPA regulations and politics and anything that goes in your brain that you, you know, absolutely cannot control. You're just thinking about breathing. And then while you're doing it, the, maybe the answer comes because you're not concentrating too hard.
I think we've overrated the power of thinking. We're moving into a period in our history where we're going to find out that things like intuition and instinct are stronger than our ability to think. There are things that we inherently know or we sense that is a truer sense to what is going on than just racking our brain about it. And especially in this age of information, you are so overloaded with information that to work our way out of that is not typically going to be to overthink it. Because if you're in the mode of using thinking to deal with the amount of information that's going on, you will definitely be in headache mode.
Yeah. Well, and it's all so easily accessible.
And along with that, a very free mode of mind where it's freer to speak openly, think openly.
Yeah.
Not designed to be hyped or selling a message.
We kind of have to go. We've been on this track for a while, so we kind of have to go back because I know that all the listeners are going to want to know more about the show and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. One thing about this show, in it being so thought-provoking after having downplayed thought for a while here, it certainly makes you consider other possibilities of how the world can be. Which is a great, great sort of concept. I think the world can certainly benefit from being so mindless and having some stimulating artistic kind of thoughts, period. Sounds like a rambling artist.
No, it is. Because maybe if you watch this show, you think maybe you didn't know every fucking thing, right? You didn't know it all. Maybe you didn't know it all. I mean, that's what you think about when you watch this show. It's just such a mind-blowing concept for a lot of people. And I, like I said, I posted online the other day that if a certain politician were to be elected, people might want to watch Man in the High Castle. Because we're going down that road right now. It's like a steep, like a locomotive, and like we can't stop it. No brakes.
Well, it certainly addresses how throughout history we've had leaders that promote fear rather than promote any true possibilities of positive things within us as people or positive ideas that could move us in a different way. I think certainly Bernie Sanders kind of triggered that enough to
at least make people realize they could start a movement.
Well, he created change by just appearing on the scene and starting movement. The movement is now started. That thought is now viral. That there are things to consider that can be changed.
And so that might be the upcoming premise of the show. I don't want to give anything away. That's all I'm going to say is that change might be the upcoming premise of the show. I have looked into the book, but the show deviates from the book quite a bit. And we'll pick up where the book left off. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, and that's the kind of interesting part of the show. Is that there was supposed to be a sequel to the book.
Uh-huh.
That was never. And so to have limited material, how to carry it into subsequent series. It takes a lot of creativity on the part of the executive producers and the writers to project possibilities of where to go from such a powerful premise for a series.
Now, the author of the book, is the author still alive?
No.
I thought the author had passed.
And he passed in the 80s.
Yeah. So does he have any family members? I mean, where did you have to go to get creative authority for this book?
Yeah, his daughter, Issa Dick Hackett, is one of the executive producers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and you had mentioned that earlier.
She no, it's okay. She's in charge of his all of his material. She's an heir to all of his material and is working on expanding other parts of books and short stories that he had written. And she's one of the guiding lights, the direction that we're moving in. It's so great to be part of a project where you get to be involved in the creation of it,
right,
or the further furtherance of that creativity. And so we certainly discuss what possibilities there are for the show to go, because it wasn't that material. And at this moment, it's really looking at that there's no limit to which direction.
Because this show has a little bit of every element into it. I mean, we're talking military, drama, supernatural, thriller-ish type of material. There's everything in it. But it's all done in such a cohesive way.
Well, the one thing that of course, and being very selfish about the content, my character, is it has such a Western perspective, and then the character that I play has such an Eastern perspective, that it really puts pieces together of two very opposite cultures and looks through my character to blend the two or find solutions that in my mind represent more of an East-Western concept. That's what drew me to the story, of course, and now being part of.
You've got a lot of personal experience to draw
from,
huh?
To draw from, exactly.
Let's take a little coffee break, and then we'll get back to it.
All right, that was part one of our interview with Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa. Stay tuned for part two, which airs in November, when Cary dishes about the cast of Man in the High Castle. You don't want to miss it. Thank you for listening, everybody. I'm Danny McMartin with Rad Radio.